Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of a Dhamma talk on the importance of developing contentment and gratitude in Dhamma practice. This talk was presented in Clinton, New Jersey on March the 2nd, 2017. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's talk is called Contentment and Gratitude in Practice, and there's an article on this on the website, but let me just read it and we'll talk about it a little bit. The refined mindfulness developed through wholehearted engagement with the Eightfold Path brings the qualities of mind of contentment and gratitude into our practice. Contentment and gratitude overcome all of the five hindrances to practice of desire, or sensual desire, ill will, laziness, restlessness, and doubt. A mind of contentment and gratitude is developed by acceptance and awareness of who and what we are as life occurs, meaning we just talked about not taking things personally. It's simply what's unfolding in my life. It's not coming after me. It is only conditioned mind that creates the sense that we should be different than we are and that our life experience should be different than it is. The Buddha teaches, this is an interesting thing because the Buddha was teaching, this isn't a direct sutta, but he was teaching this idea in northern India at the time that was the caste system was firmly entrenched. I mean, it's still remnants of it today. But it was just accepted that you were born in a certain level, and that was it. You could never, ever get out of that level. And one of the first things the Buddha taught was that's not true. You know? It's only our minds that say that we're stuck in a situation and that can never change. The Buddha teaches that life is dukkha, loosely translated as stress, unsatisfactoriness, disappointment, or suffering. The truth of dukkha is the first of the four noble truths. The second noble truth, clinging and desire cause dukkha, or at least our individual contributions to it, and that by eliminating desire and developing contentment, suffering will cease. And I'm talking about initial practice, but also the culmination of the path, because that contentment is also that mind of equanimity that is always at peace with what's occurring. I'm content, and that, if you think about that contentment, it doesn't come from outside situations because there's always going to be disappointment, unsatisfactoriness, and suffering in the world, and we're going to experience it. But we can develop contentment with what is because we understand the true nature of life. You know, and that's where we really can maintain contentment. And if you look at these, and maybe I'm getting too subtle in this, but contentment is also an aspect of right view. We see things clearly, so we're accepting of it.
There's equanimity where despite problems and stress and suffering, you can still have equanimity and peace of mind.
Yeah.
But is that really the same as saying, that's not really to me the same as saying, that's just there's no should. Right? I mean, you were saying
Yes, there's no should, there just is what is occurring.
Right. So it's not that it's okay, it's just that's what is.
Yes, yeah. Again, we might be playing with semantics. To some people, saying it's okay is just general acceptance. But for most of us, saying that something is okay is a judgment in some way. I approve of what's occurring. So even in a situation where suffering is present, that could be this kind of grim determination, like, I'm all right with this, rather than understand that it is another temporary situation. That doesn't mean we should feel great if we're, you know, if we just broke a leg. It doesn't mean, you know, our leg's hanging off to the side and everything's wonderful. That's not it. It simply means you don't take it personally. You were able to react or respond in a meaningful way, meaning call 911. The inner situation is what's different. Some people might say, how could this happen to me? Or why was I so stupid that I didn't see the ball that I just stepped on? Blame themselves. Or blame the kid that left the ball. You know, I'm just using just a kind of a silly example. But you can take the simple act that I broke a leg and really run with it and start blaming the world or blaming yourself or blaming God or whoever you want to blame. Blaming bad karma. None of that is helpful. But we can be content even with a broken leg by simply accepting this is what's occurred and it's time to go to the hospital. That's just practical. And does that answer your question?
Yeah. I mean, it's not saying, oh, it's okay that, let's say, this person has cancer. It's not, you know, it's not okay.
It's not.
But how am I going to deal with it?
I was just talking to a student. I'm recording this. I don't want it to sound like I'm talking directly about him. Anyway, he's talking about his father, who's very sick, and one of the problems that he has is cancer, but he's not facing it. He's not doing anything about it. In other words, he's completely detached from reality. And he wanted to know what should I do about it. I said, well, you might not be able to do anything if he doesn't want to face reality, but that's how you present it. There's no magic about it. You need to sit your dad down and say, this is what's going on. This is what you need to do. And as a family, this is what we want you to do. But also to understand, it was the last thing I said to him, that he may not, and you need to be at peace with that. So there's a whole lot of different things going on here. One is, and you brought it up, we find out that a loved one has cancer, or that I have cancer, or some other awful disease. There's a difference between approval and acceptance, and I certainly don't have to approve of it, but I have to accept it if I'm going to respond mindfully to the world, and probably not start isolating other people around me because overreaction or complete detachment. I don't care. And as I'm saying, I'm thinking of a couple other family members. We probably all have them that had something awful happen to them, and they just didn't want to talk about it. And that's just not helpful, because now you're isolating your other family members. And of course, we understand where all that comes from. It comes from craving and clinging to, on an individual level, that things be different than they are, even when they can't be. Again, I think that answers the question.
Yeah.
So there's a, as we develop the Dhamma, we understand the significant difference between acceptance and approval. We don't have to approve of things, but we accept them simply because that's what's occurred or what is going to occur. So how to end desire? This is the basic Buddhist teaching. The Buddha found that it was not skillful or effective to avoid all things which lead to desire arising, living the life of an ascetic.
Excuse me.
Developing mindfulness of all manifestations of desire and the impermanence of all things will lead to mindfully ceasing desire. If all objects of desire are impermanent and lead to suffering, why continue to grasp after them? Again, it's another way of saying just don't take things personally. You don't need to acquire everything in the world in order to be happy. In fact, you don't have to acquire anything. And again, that doesn't mean that we should sell off all our belongings and move in under a bridge. It simply means to not create attachments and identities to what we have. And if we happen to have a lot of nice stuff, recognize that you're fortunate to have it, but don't create an identity over it. And that can lead to true generosity, too. And I mean that in a way. I keep coming up against what I think is almost foolish generosity, meaning giving to the point that it hurts. It shouldn't hurt. There's situations where people aren't taking care of their families and their responsibilities because they're so intent on being generous. And there's no wisdom there. There really isn't. And I'm mentioning that because that's something else that came up recently with two of my students. As all acquisitions and accomplishments are impermanent, there will always be an unsatisfactory experience to a life based on sensory fulfillment of an ego personality. The agitation brought on by desire creates an unsettled mind, constantly distracted by fulfilling its own insatiable needs, rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Integrating the understanding of impermanence develops a deep awareness and appreciation of life as life occurs. Dispassionate mindfulness of life as life occurs, without the demands of an ego personality, of anatta, brings lasting peace and happiness. When the Buddha describes an awakened, fully mature human being, he described that human being as released or unbound from clinging, meaning clinging to everything that we've used to establish a self-identity, and in simplest terms, clinging to self-referential views. That's an awakened human being. And if you can imagine that, if you haven't already experienced it, what would that be like, to have no attachments and yet be fully engaged, fully mindful of your life as it occurs? No distractions is another way of describing a mind free of self-referential views. It really is that state of unending contentment, unending peace. And yet we're still mindfully engaged in the world, and probably in a way that's much more effective than we ever were, because we're not distracted by wants and desires and what we think an ego personality needs.
Now, I haven't asked a lot of questions in these things, but lately I've had a life experience where I was fairly miserable in my last job. There was really no reason for me to be that miserable. I just couldn't make it right. just personality issues, or whatever. I couldn't get comfortable. I couldn't do my business, and I got in my own way. And I switched jobs, and it's like a weight was lifted off my shoulder. I'm still the same person. I didn't do anything different. I just came into a different environment where I was, my abilities were trusted. But if this job didn't come along, I would still be in the other one. So I guess one thing I need to really learn how to do, accept maybe this isn't ideal, but then how to still be able to function in an ideal, or less, much less than ideal. When I finally left, someone said to me, I'm surprised you lasted this long because of the person I was working with, mm-hmm. who was nice, but there were issues in terms of how he dealt with things. So I'm like, oh, I didn't realize everyone was thinking that. And apparently a lot of people were. Yeah. They were shocked that I lasted that long. So, but there was nothing really that horrible about it. It was just this insidiousness.
So you're talking about a few different situations here. Other people... In this instance, I guess this person was had an authority over you,
yeah.
So a boss. Mm-hmm. Other people, including bosses, are included in that dukkha, and that mm-hmm. doesn't mean they're bad or anything else.
Yeah.
It just means that the world, including its people, are often a part of unsatisfactory and disappointing experiences, just the way it is, especially when we're dealing with people who have yet to awaken, who've gained full human maturity, which is most of the population. And again, it's not a harsh judgment. It's important to recognize that just because we may be changing and developing a true understanding of who we are in relation to the world, most other people aren't, and they're not likely to. So rather than create in our minds the insistence that other people be different because it's not likely to change, sometimes the best thing to do is to do just what you did, is move on.
But let's say I couldn't move on. Is the idea that if I was not feeling put upon or tense or feeling like an idiot or whatever it was that I was feeling, if I could get past that and just say, this is my job, this is what I'm here to do, theoretically I should be able to function fully regardless of, I'm not talking about, there was nothing abusive in the situation mm-hmm. at all. I should be able to function regardless, I should be able to function and adapt to my environment.
Well, say that again.
Function and...
No, say the should part again.
Oh. No, but if one doesn't have the lack of the insecurity, you know, always fear that something's going to go wrong, you're going to get fired or you're going to make a mistake or whatever the issue is in a job or... Mm-hmm. There's too much work or whatever it is. If one can have that equanimity, that acknowledgement, yep, that stress, then theoretically one would be able to function in that environment. Maybe not thoroughly enjoy it, but function in it.
That's the theory, but like all theories, they can't always be proven correct.
Mm-hmm.
Even in some situations they may, some situations they may not be. A fully awakened, fully mature human being would be able to be in most situations and maintain their peacefulness. But they may decide that this situation is prone to causing agitation in anybody's mind, and it's time to leave. So this is, again, the developing the Dhamma is not a way of being withdrawn from the world. And if you happen to be in a situation and you have fully developed the Dhamma and it's still hurtful, it's time to move. If you're not there yet, if you're just developing the Dhamma and you find yourself in a situation that is constantly creating agitation in your mind and you don't feel like you can get past it, you do what you just did. And continue to give yourself the space to develop the awakening and be at peace with it. It's never useful practice to continue to run away from things.
Right.
But at some point, it's time to move on. The very first retreat I gave, I was talking in general about not self and that there's no such thing as a self, meaning our self-referential views, not that there's nothing here. But this person was taking it the other way, that he was rooted in other schools that talk about the nothingness of self and the emptiness of self, and he thought that's where I was leading. And so he asked a question: if you're standing on a train tracks and a train is coming at you, what are you supposed to do then? My answer was, you take 2 steps to the right. You don't prove that there's nothing there. You know, that's not the answer. The same is true if we're in a what is basically an impossible situation. And again, that I don't know for sure, but that might be your situation. The sensible thing is to just move out of the situation. And then if our minds are always going to play out in front of us, the quality of our minds. And so if we have the type of mind that's prone to agitation, it's likely going to come up again, whether on the job or in other areas of our life. But that's also the beauty of dukkha, because it shows us the quality of our mind. It shows us what we need to be looking at and what we need to change. You know, so it was also a good example of acceptance and approval. You certainly don't approve of the way this man was treating you. Was he a man? I don't know.
Yeah.
This person was treating you. Mm-hmm. But you have to accept it because you're there on the job. Mm-hmm. And again, we could take this too far. If there was real legal issues, if it was really abusive, then there's other areas. But in this situation, it sounds like you did the most reasonable thing you could do. That's it. You know, there were situations. This is just to kind of bring up the point that just because we're practicing the Dhamma, nothing bad will ever happen to us, which is, I'm not saying we do this, but it's kind of a common understanding that if I'm just this most wonderful centered person, I'm kind of protected from the world. The Buddha's cousin on two situations tried to kill him, and he came very close on two separate occasions. Even the Buddha, you know, the most compassionate human that ever walked the earth. So this isn't an escape from the world. Mm-hmm. But the Buddha also knew how to react perfectly to it. Just once it goes back to the train metaphor, Devadatta tried to roll this big boulder down off a mountain on the Buddha as the Buddha was walking down the road. And because he was not distracted, he heard the big boulder coming, took 2 steps to the right and watched it roll. I won't tell the rest of the story. It's another one. But, you know, again, we have to live in the world. And every situation can be a different application. And a good example of that is the Buddha gave his talk on the Four Noble Truths, and he gave it other times. But he gave, they say, 84,000 other discourses, other suttas through the next 45 years of his life. And that's just that's a number that just means a lot. He didn't actually do 84,000. But every talk he gave was situational and how that situation related back to the Four Noble Truths. So if you take any one of the suttas out of context, it's hard to even make sense to see how they apply. But when you understand that everything he gave was in that context, then it's obvious this is what the Buddha was getting at in this situation. So he probably would have said, I think you did the best you could. You know, good for you. And two good questions. I just lost the page. So I'm going to go back one paragraph. The agitation brought on by desire creates an unsettled mind, constantly distracted by fulfilling its own insatiable needs rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Integrating the understanding of impermanence develops a deep awareness and appreciation of life as life occurs. Dispassionate mindfulness of life as life occurs without the demands of an ego personality of anatta brings lasting peace and happiness. Contentment with what occurs brings gratitude for human life and deep appreciation for the simple and profound understanding developed through the Eightfold Path. At its most basic, contentment and gratitude merge into a singular quality of mind free of desire. By integrating all 8 factors of the Eightfold Path into our lives, we put aside desire and aversion, further developing contentment and gratitude. Shamatha Vipassana meditation, practiced within the framework of the Eightfold Path, develops the deep concentration necessary to avoid the distraction brought by desire and interrupts conditioned mind's need for constant sensory fulfillment. As concentration deepens, the practical understanding of the impermanence of all objects, events, views, and ideas brings an end to self-referential clinging and is self-defined by clinging to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas. A mind resting in the qualities of contentment and gratitude, at peace with what is occurring, is free of the need for additional distraction. Deep and abiding gratitude for life as life occurs becomes the ongoing experience of a life rooted in the wisdom, virtue, and concentration developed within the Eightfold Path. That's the end of that that article. I'm trying to check the time. Okay, we have a little time for any discussion, any questions on what I just read. So when we come to even a basic understanding of what we're doing in this practice, and we develop just a little bit of right view, meaning we now understand that our mind is inclined towards a useful and skillful direction, immediately contentment can start setting in, or it can be something that we generate. We can be mindful that one of the things that I think I'm most fortunate about is that I was able to find the direct teachings of the Buddha and that they had a useful effect on my life. In other words, it wasn't just something that I kind of engaged in because it might be cool or my friends were doing it or I'm looking for an escape or anything like that. It actually had a useful benefit to me. It wasn't just another thing to look at. I'm so fortunate for that. And I'm fortunate and very content in the fact that I have a human mind that's able to understand this. And what I mean by that is not that I have this extraordinary mind, I have an ordinary mind. And that the Buddha taught his Dhamma for people like me and you. There's nothing special. We don't have to have a special lineage or a special birth. We don't have to have any kind of special understanding or intelligence. We begin Dhamma practice where we are in our lives, and it can take us very quickly in some cases, and I don't mean 5 minutes, but maybe in a couple years, to that place of true contentment and true gratitude for simply having a human life. And having that human life, incorporated in that human life, is the ability to develop profound understanding. And we all can do that. There's the talk. Any questions? We'll go around the room after we meditate. But okay, let's meditate. Is 20 minutes okay for all of us? I think we've all been meditating long enough that that's fine.
I am going to have to, you guys start. I'm going to have to use the facilities.
Okay.
I just drove an hour.
Oh,
geez. To get here from my new job.
All right, you'll join us when you come back?
Yeah, I'll join
okay.
You.
So find your relaxed meditative posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And holding your back straight, but not stiff. Your ears aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel. But holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room. Settle onto your seats. Settle into your bodies. And settle into your minds. Take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. To be mindful of your breath in your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath in your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of meditation is to not be distracted by your own thoughts. So when you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Relaxing your thoughts, remaining mindful of your breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes with callbacks every 5.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.